Hi, and welcome to the FIF Pro podcast, Changing the Game. I'm Allie Riley. In this series, we'll be speaking to international female footballers about their personal journeys to success and find out what it's taken for them to reach the top of their game. And in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the FIFA Women's World Cup, we'll also be looking at how women's football has evolved over the last three decades and discuss what more needs to be done to protect the well-being of players and ensure that future generations can reach their full potential. Today, I'm talking with Christine Sinclair.
I've always said that I want to leave this sport in a better place than I found it when I joined the national team or professional teams, and to have been a part of that change has been remarkable.
Christine debuted for the Canadian national team at the age of 16. She has played in and scored at five World Cup tournaments, is the country's top goal scorer and most capped player. She also holds the record for most international goals scored by a player from either the men or women's game. Christine has been named Canadian Player of the Year an incredible 14 times. In this episode, we'll be looking back at the Women's World Cup of 2007. Christine Sinclair, a true honor. Welcome to the Changing the Game FIFA Pro podcast.
Hi, Allie. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Sinky. Does anyone call you Christine? I mean, when you introduce yourself to a new teammate, is it always Sinky or?
No, I usually introduce myself as Christine.
And then they have to figure out for themselves that everyone calls you Sink?
Well, then I say, but everyone calls me Sink. But my family calls me Christine. And, you know, usually when they throw in the middle name or something, Christine Margaret. That's, yeah, that's never good.
Okay, well, Christine Margaret, here we go.
Oh, dear.
You shouldn't have told me that.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, we are going to be talking about the 2007 World Cup, but I have to mention that, of course, the 2007 World Cup wasn't even your first World Cup. You helped Canada to a fourth place finish at the 2003 World Cup when you were only 19 years old. You made your debut for the national team at 16. What was it like coming into a national team at such a young age? Were the older players welcoming to you? I mean, I know you had already made yourself known in the under 18 national team, but what was that like being so young, 16 years old?
Actually, the team was pretty welcoming. I mean, the team had just had a very rough 99 World Cup, and the coach for that team, you know, was relieved of his duties, and they brought in Evan Pellerud, and he kind of brought in a bunch of youngsters, obviously knowing that the program needed an overhaul. And so he brought in a lot of us like kids, and like an Aaron McLeod. I mean, we've been on the team for so long together. Yeah, it was obviously it's an intimidating place to go at such a young age, but they were very welcoming, and I mean, we were just trying to build. I mean, like the team struggled, so we were just trying to do anything to survive.
Yeah. Well, now you mentioned Aaron as well. You've had a core group that I guess it's starting to change, but for younger players coming in now and younger players coming into elite environments, how different do you think it is with the way the game has changed and kind of the status of young players around the world when they come into these environments? I mean, for me, it's so different when I see the young players, this new generation.
I mean, yeah, like you said, you know how it is. These youngsters have it so easy.
They sure do.
And it's like, I love it because I've always said that I want to leave this sport in a better place than I found it when I joined the national team or professional teams. And to have been a part of that change has been remarkable. And to see the opportunities that the youngsters have now, whether it's in North America, whether it's going overseas, and then just you look at the Olympics and World Cups. The game has changed so much over the course of my career, and it's not even close to what players deserve. We're not close to that, but we're at least moving in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, what would you say it was like being on the national team? What were the resources like? I know you mentioned you had a new coach when you were coming in, but compared to what it's like now, you know, going to a 2003, 2007 World Cup, maybe staff, kit, the resources, that kind of thing. Can you even compare what it's like now?
Oh, it's night and day. It's the kit. Oh my gosh. Like, I've seen pictures from those World Cups and even like trainings and stuff. And you're like, we are wearing like extra large men's square
pictures. Very square. Yes.
Very square. I mean, they don't need to be an hourglass either, but.
Right. That's a whole nother issue.
Maybe somewhere in between. But yeah, just, I think the resources were so limited back then. I think of our staff, it was like a coach, an assistant coach, one medical person, like it's just, and then even like the technology that mm-hmm. is now such a big part of the game compared to what it was back then. I mean, our recovery days, I remember we used to like, this seems like the perfect day to go for a 90-minute run. Like, it was just like, what? So I'm so glad that has changed. And even just the standards of tournaments. I mean, obviously the Olympics were pandemic filled, but the World Cup in France, just the standards across the board have changed so much, and the level of professionalism from start to finish.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, specifically in Canada, what do you remember when you were joining the national team and heading to those early World Cups? What was kind of the landscape like in terms of support for the women's national team? Again, we can contrast that to what I now witnessed weeks ago being part of your celebration tour after the Olympics. I mean, you guys came fourth, you know, was there excitement around the national team heading then into 2007?
No. yeah, so we finished fourth in the World Cup and like no one in Canada cared. I don't even think people in Canada, unless you're like a diehard soccer fan, knew that there was a Women's World Cup in a way. Like wow. It was just so different. And, you know, I mean, obviously it was a while ago, but I'd say the support really changed. I mean, it's been building, but in 2012, when we were successful in London, and then on the back of that, when we hosted the World Cup, that's kind of, I'd say in Canada, when things changed and it became more mainstream and more popular, and all of a sudden we'd play a home game in front of 20,000 fans. I mean, that had never really happened before, but yeah, hosting the World Cup, I'd say was the big moment for our country. Yeah, I think that's the turning point. I'd have to pick that one.
So do you think that the excitement around women's soccer, I know I've read that you saw one of the 99 World Cup games and you played in college in the US. So is there wasn't kind of that a little bit of a trickle over effect from being so close to somewhere where women's soccer was on the rise with, and I, of course, I know your rival national teams, but I would have thought there would be some kind of more awareness with the US team and what they were kind of investing. Again, very different than now, but with the excitement there.
No, I, like I said, I think if you were a diehard women's soccer fan, which back then there weren't many, of course there was like some, like for me, like I had a Mia Hamm jersey growing up, like, you know, things like that. But in terms of like the support within Canada back in those days, I can't say there was much, even as successful as the US was and how close they are to Canada, it didn't really move across the border, especially, I mean, before I joined the national team, it was like really non-existent. At least when Evan was hired as the head coach, I'd say our federation started to put more funding towards the women's program and youth teams and things like that. In the past, I had never, honestly, before the 99 World Cup, and I'm a diehard women's soccer fan. Right. I was like, who's our national team? Like, we have one of those?
Right. So when did you even know? I guess the first question would be, had you always dreamt of playing soccer? Was that your big dream? And did you know that it was possible to play professionally? Did you know about the national team? Were you watching soccer on TV or women's sports in general?
So I, growing up, I was convinced I was going to be a Major League Baseball player. That's why I wear number 12. My hero was Roberto Alomar, baseball player. That was my goal in life. But I mean, I played all different sports growing up. And then eventually soccer just sort of took over, and it was never with the intent of playing professionally or playing for Canada. I'd say as I got older, it became, hey, I want to get a scholarship to the US. That was the next step. And then kind of while that was happening, I got called into my first national team camp. You know, things like those two things kind of happened together. And then, yeah, I mean, I watched the 99 World Cup. That was really like life-changing for me coming down to Portland and watching some of those games, which it's kind of weird. Now I play in that same stadium.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there being like, I'm going to play in the next one. And it, cause that was the first time I'd seen it live. Like, oh my God, women do this for a living. The quality was so high. And yeah, that was kind of like my aha moment that, hey, people do this. This seems cool. I'm in.
Yeah. I think we have really similar experiences in that sense. And I think of the young girls now who don't have to wait to be lucky enough and to be able to afford to go see a game live, to already know when they're little because they've seen the US play on TV or they've seen you or Alex or Marta in a commercial, you know, or on a billboard because of the sports brand you have. I think that's so incredible. But I was exactly the same. You know, I didn't really know about the national team, but I saw the 99 World Cup and I thought, wouldn't that be so cool to do that? But my, you know, farthest away goal was to play in college. You know, that was kind of all that I knew that we could do. You know, it wasn't until my senior year that I even knew that we could do something after. And that's where we met playing on the same team.
Oh my God, that was so long ago.
I know.
And you were such a young pup.
You too, kind of.
Well, no, I was still older. But.
Yeah. I mean, thinking of the WPS and the NWSL, how far do you think we've come now in the US, these renditions of a professional league?
I mean, it's easy to say we've come very far. I mean, I think of the days in the WPS playing for FC Gold Pride or Western New York and just the day-to-day standards that are in place now in the NWSL are just light years ahead of where we were. But that being said, I've been very fortunate to play for Portland throughout the course of the NWSL. And I know that not everyone's experiences have been the same. I mean, even within Portland's organization, I think of year one to where we are now. And it's just like, is that the same league? Is that even the same club? But I would love to see the standards continue to increase, but also become across the board, like how we should be treated. And unfortunately, I don't think we're quite there. I think we're getting there, but there's still a long way to go. And players still need to fight for things that I don't think we should be having to fight for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, back to 2007 and that World Cup, I know it probably wasn't one of your favorites, the most remarkable, but I think it's cool to look at maybe where the national team was at that time compared to the two bronze medals and then now the gold medal in the Olympics. And well, first, do you have any positive memories from, you did score 3 goals in China from 2007?
Any positive memories? None are jumping out.
I know, you're a winner.
No, but the one thing about the Canadian team that I've always absolutely loved are the people. And, you know, you could throw out this World Cup or this Olympics. And besides recent ones, I probably don't have too many like on-field memories. Like that was amazing. But for me, it's all about the connections I've made and the friends I've made and the people that will be still significant people in my life when we're all done playing. And that's, I think, the thing about our national team that makes us unique is just the culture we have and the connections we have.
How much do you think that culture and the mindset has shifted from a tournament where, you know, important to qualify, good to be there, score some goals, to now where I know there was a mantra about changing the color of the medal, which, you know, for other teams, you know, like my team, like to even have a medal, you know, but you've gotten to that point where you were so determined and that was such a focus point and then you achieved it. So was it, I know John Herdman was there for a long time, Bev coming in, you know, while you've had a positive and very close culture within the team, has there been outside sources or what has it been that's then shifted that mentality even more to being the best team to win these championships?
I mean, you know, John, And I credit him with pretty much everything that's happened with our national team since he came on board in, I think it was early 2012 or late 2011. And like you said, we'd always been close. We'd always been like a great culture, but he brought this sense of, okay, great. You're good friends. You're going to be friends for years, but let's go win. And the belief that we could do it. And he has this unique ability to like rally the troops and get you believing that you can conquer the world, even though no one else in the world thinks you can. So I credit him with a lot, and even the continuation of that success over the course of three Olympic Games now, I credit that to him too, because he was the first one, I think, that really started to focus on the youth and the development of young players, bringing them in at a young age and like putting them in the fire and seeing if they could float, you know? And you're seeing that like Kadisha, Ash, like Jessie's, these players that are still so young, but have so much experience and belief. Yeah, I think John, he was a good one to come on board. And now he's with our men's team and doing the same.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Just nuts.
So at what point in the 2020, which happened in 2021 Olympics, did you really know or start believing we can win this whole thing? Or was it really that confidence from the get-go?
So we had been successful in two previous Olympic Games. Our team, for some reason, has an ability to do well in those like cram tournaments where it's like game, recover, game. Mm-hmm. Players, staff have like mastered that. So we knew heading in that, you know, we could be successful here. Obviously in the women's game now, there's a handful of teams that can win. You need a little luck on your side. But when the Olympics got postponed, these Olympic Games in some weird way were like built for our team because of the pandemic, because of a lack of freedom. You couldn't leave your hotel. You were confined. I mean, you lived it. And I remember staying in hotels with other teams and they couldn't wait to get out. They couldn't wait to be free, be able to walk outside and go to Starbucks, things like that. Whereas our team were having Mario Kart competitions and things like that, you know, So it's in that moment that I think our culture really, really helped us. And we had made that decision as soon as those Olympics were postponed to use every day. It was a choice to use every day better than our opponents were. So whether that was Zoom meetings with units or says running like,
oh yeah, it was on your workouts. Didn't end up helping me, but I'm glad it helped you guys.
You know, like,
yeah, no, that was incredible. Every player on there doing their workouts together.
Yeah. I think players chose to not use it as an excuse and try to make the most of it. I mean, obviously everyone has their good days and bad days, especially in the pandemic, but as a team, like, it really brought us together in a unique way.
Well, I want to hear a little more insight for any of the older listeners out there. How do you manage that recovery in such quick turnarounds?
I mean, it's been a process for me. I think first and foremost, I've been very fortunate in my career in terms of injuries and just how my body responds to the stress of a game. I know I'm lucky and fortunate, but I definitely put in a lot of work. So I sat down the past couple Olympic Games. I've sat down with our medical staff, like every single one of them, and we've come up with a plan for me from the second the whistle blows to end game one. Like, this is what's happening to make sure you're ready to go for game two, like massages, recovery sessions, things. I mean, you name it, it's in there. So I give a lot of credit to our staff that have spent a lot of time with me and working with John or Bev. I mean, they've been awesome. And they're just like, look, for a few of the older players, they're like, we don't care if you don't train from the start of the Olympics to the end of the Olympics, as long as you guys are ready come game day, like the rest can be done on a PowerPoint, you know. They've been very helpful in that sense. Yeah, they've got a good team around me. What can I say?
Well, at what point did you kind of realize that you would have to balance taking care of your body and playing all these games? I mean, you've had this long career, but were you always smart about that? Or did it take, you know, practice or time? Or, I mean, I know you've been lucky with injuries, but, you know, I think a lot of players out there and myself included have such a problem with overtraining, and it's taken a long time to understand kind of the recovery side of things. I mean, have you changed a lot since your earlier pro days or national team days?
100%. I think a lot of us are the same. More is always better, you know. I'm going to outwork my opponents. And that was like my mantra for the longest time. And it still is sometimes. And it costs me, like early in January this year, in the off season, I worked too hard and got a stress fracture in my foot. Like, so I still have that weird voice inside of me saying more, more, more. But overall, I've definitely learned about balance and knowing when I need to peak and knowing that, you know what, the games are actually the most important part of this. You'll definitely get your work in and train, but maybe instead of doing 20 sprints, we're now doing 10, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think there's a normal part where that players that have had long careers are wired a little, they're crazy. Like, and I think that's, there's a reason why players get to the level that they're at. And it's usually not by just doing the bare minimum. But I've definitely had to learn to, like, especially in the course of a long season, like, okay, just chill.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, physical health is so important in maintaining a long career. And I think mental health as well. And that's something that I'm glad is becoming so much more of an open topic, and so many more public figures are speaking about that. How have you been able to have that healthy balance too? With obviously is going to be a lot of pressure on you, a lot of eyes on you being who you are and the legend that you are. So what do you focus on? How do you make sure that you stay kind of happy and in a good mental space?
I just definitely work in progress. I'm still not there. I don't think many athletes are there. But I've definitely worked with a sports psychologist from our national team for years now. And my biggest challenge, I'm not big on social media. I'm not big on caring what the outside world has to say about my performance.
Yeah.
But my biggest thing is me and in my own head and self-doubt and focusing on mistakes. And that's just where I naturally go. So I've spent a lot of time on really nailing down my identity on the field, knowing that what I can go back to, what I bring, and being 100% confident in that. And like I said earlier, there's good days and bad days. But typically for me, if I can focus on the two or three things that I know I bring to our team and the things that I can control, and that tends to recenter me, whether it's in the middle of a practice, in the middle of a game. That's been my biggest obstacle, I'd say, in my career. I don't care what the outside world says. It's just whatever goes on in my head.
Yeah, well, that's often the harshest critic, really.
It really is.
And the one that not is just friendly. Stuck with you doesn't mean you don't have to open your phone or your computer. It's just there.
Just always right there.
But speaking of which, you and social media, you're definitely, as a very, very well-known public figure, one of the most humble people I know in general, but, you know, and a private person and not up to date with all the riffraff, everything going on. But I got the shock of my life when I saw you on TikTok. What is your relationship with that commercial side of the game? And social media has, I think, played a very large role. I talked to Lucy Bronze about this in growing the women's game, because it's kind of a straight up, people say they don't care about women's soccer. And you're like, look at the engagement, look at the highlights. There is that. But you personally, you know, it's not really your jam.
It's definitely not my jam. And it's something I've been like shoved into over the past couple years. Like you said, I'm very much a private person. I don't think the world needs to know or really cares what I did today in my afternoon or what I had for dinner yesterday. But that being said, I do recognize the impact it can have on our sport and just one of my goals is always trying to grow the game. And if that means every once in a while posting something, I'm all in. But it's very hard for me, especially now that people know that I'm not that into it. Like I'm that if I do post something, they're like, oh my God. And then I feel like extra judged and like, oh my God, did I say something wrong? Did I like, it's just a lot. But I do understand how it can help grow the game. And I can see it firsthand, the engagement that individuals have. And still, I'm still not going to post what I had for dinner, but I'm learning.
Yes.
One day, maybe.
Well, I have two comments on that. First, I think that you were the one who kind of broke the news that your bus had caught on fire with Portland.
Okay. Can I be honest right now?
Please.
Okay. So I might have some help with some social media stuff.
As celebrities do.
And our bus caught on fire. Yes, that did happen. And I just sent a video to my agent and like, this happened. Like, and so maybe a couple minutes later, our like team admin comes and is like, hey, before everything gets like, just keep it off social media until we at least, and like next thing you know, it's.
And you're like, I'm not on social media.
Well, I didn't even think. And next thing you know, people are like, Sink, you posted this? I'm like, oh, darn. But it was entertaining. Come on. Like.
It was, and it was everywhere. And everyone was also, I think the surprise of the bus being on fire was like equaled to the surprise that Sink is on TikTok.
Oh my Lord. That was a day.
Yeah, the video went viral.
Even it ended up on the news, and it's like here in Portland, it's like the Portland women's soccer team narrowly escapes bus explosion. And we're like, I don't know if it was quite like that, but you know, there were some flames.
Well, the other side of it, social media, I think, which I know you understand as well, is it's providing financial opportunities for players, for us. And I think that's another thing that is a very good thing, but it's also, wouldn't it be so nice if we are getting paid enough to do our jobs that was more of just a bonus if you really are excited about it and interested in doing it. So yeah, one day we'll get there, I hope.
I mean, I think the league is growing and just women's sports in general are growing. But for some reason, the salaries seem to be the last thing to like jump. And you just see such a discrepancy. It's not even between the men and women. It's just mind-blowing the fact that some players in the NWSL are like barely making above minimum wage. And that's the part that's completely unacceptable to me.
Absolutely. And right now, you know, we are waiting and hoping that this CBA that we're working so hard as a players union to make a difference and make a change. I think we should hopefully know in the next month the outcomes of that. But definitely increasing the minimum salary is a very, very big focus point.
Yeah. I mean, the whole no more side hustles, I thought was very powerful. You know what? This player is working from what, February 1 to maybe the end of November, like pouring their heart and soul, physically exhausting themselves. And it's like, oh, and by the way, you have to now go coach in the evening just to like make ends meet. That's a hard one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it definitely plays a role when we're talking about players accepting, whether it's verbal, sexual, racial abuse, because they don't feel like they can afford to say something because they're already barely making ends meet.
Yeah. And I think also for so long in the women's game, the fear of speaking up because the fear was that, well, the league will fold or your team will fold and the league will fold. And I don't think any player wanted to be responsible for that. I mean, that should never be the case. Like people should be able to have safe work environments.
Right.
Yeah. I'm just so proud of the players that have stood up and shared their stories.
Absolutely. Well, on a more positive note.
Okay.
I want to know, do you really still love the game so much? What is motivating you? Now you've scored more goals than every other soccer player on the planet. You have won Olympic gold. You have so much hardware professionally, internationally. What is keeping you going?
You know, Allie, you know this about me. Like, I've never focused on the awards or goals scored. That's never been my motivating factor. I think I'm a little crazy. I like to wake up every morning. I like to go training. I like the thought of trying to get better. I like the thought of trying to help my teammates and my team get better. I love the concept of soccer where, you know, a group of 25 individuals trying to like figure it out together and achieve a common goal. And I still love just kicking the ball around. You know, I'm still the dork at the end of practice shooting when everyone else is done. The medals, the accolades, they're cool. And I'm sure when my career is done, that's when I'll look back on things like that and be like, wow, like you achieved some pretty special stuff. But right now I just focus on the next day. Obviously here in Portland, trying to win another trophy here. But at the same time, I am looking forward to off season. I'm looking forward to a little bit of a break. It's been a long year.
Well, of course, you deserve that too. And you can't have kind of the one without the other. I think it's important to have that break and keep that motivation and that fun going, because you got to be able to shut off for a little while at least.
Absolutely.
But I guess just to end, being in Canada, being part of the celebration tour, the excitement is there. I think looking at the players on your team, you're not going anywhere. You have these young superstars, these talents. What needs to happen to get this pro league up and running in Canada?
Oh, Allie.
It's time, right?
Allie. That is the million-dollar question. It's something we've been fighting for as players, but in a way, there's only so much players can do.
Absolutely.
It's definitely going to take some people with some deep pocketbooks to invest in women's sports. I think we're the only team ranked in like the top 10 in the world that doesn't have a professional environment for their players to play in, which is nuts, especially when our men have MLS teams and then CPL now. And as players, we do worry that like if three podiums in a row can't bring professional soccer to Canada, when or if is it ever going to happen? And I don't know if the answer is a league. I don't know if the answer is bring in four NWSL teams. I'm not an expert on that, but something needs to happen, because as an older player on the team, I do fear that at some point our national team will get passed by, because you just look at the investment that other countries are putting into their women's programs and their professional leagues. To me, it's only a matter of time before that starts to happen. And I'm so thankful that we have, you know, retired players that are fighting behind the scenes to try and get this done. But I don't know, for some reason in Canada, people aren't willing to take a chance on women's sports. And that's disappointing to me.
No, I understand that. It doesn't really make sense, because it's so funny. We talk a lot about, and I was speaking to an Italian player about how the improvement in the resources and the league improved the national team. And I think it's a bit obvious. You've seen investment in Australia, the US, yep, of course, Spain. You can name so many examples. And then you have kind of this opposite effect that I think you can get, unfortunately, people saying, why do you need it? Because they're doing well without it. But it's, you're doing well in spite of, yep, these factors. And that's always this argument, this back and forth about investing in women and investing in women's sports. You know, just because we're doing what we're doing now without your support does not mean that you shouldn't support us. Look how good we could be with some investment.
Yeah.
And I think too, you know, we have a very, very exciting Women's World Cup coming up in 2023. And hopefully too, there'll be changes made between now and then, but also it will show the world once again what we can do. On that note, what do you think the legacy of the 2023 Women's World Cup held in New Zealand and Australia will be?
Allie, I'm so excited for you. I'm so excited for New Zealand. I've always seen New Zealand as like Canada, in the sense New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the US. Like, it's just, I know the difference that the 2015 World Cup made in Canada And I cannot wait to see the legacy that it's going to leave. The sheer numbers of fans, the young girls that will come out to watch, that will no doubt see you playing and being like, that's what I want to do. And it's pretty cool how it comes around. You know, we both had that same experience watching a World Cup. And I just think of all the young girls that are going to be in New Zealand and Australia and feel that exact same thing. And then 15 years from now, be on the national team. I can't wait. Fingers crossed. Maybe I'm part of it. We'll see.
I have a good feeling.
But it's going to be the best tournament this world's ever seen for women's soccer. And I can't wait.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for this episode of the FIF Pro podcast, Changing the Game. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do like, subscribe, and review it, or maybe share it with a friend. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.